This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. Our story this week is about a park. Not some massive city park designed by Frederick Law Olmsted or anything. Just an ordinary neighborhood park in a suburb of St. Louis. It's about 7 acres with soccer fields, 2 playgrounds, tennis courts, and a creek that runs along the back. Dave Davis worked there as a groundskeeper in the 90s. It was an unpaid position, but it came with a strange perk.
The trade-off was that you got to live in a house for free in a good school district, in a nice neighborhood, a park in your backyard.
Right at the entrance of the park, there was a house where Dave and his family lived. At the time, he and his wife were struggling to save enough money to buy their own house, so it was perfect for them.
It quite honestly felt like an answer to a prayer, because we were newly married, we had 2 children at this point, and you know, we really wanted to own a home and we wanted to get ahead.
At first glance, the house seemed like just an ordinary ranch home.
From the outside, it looked like pretty much any of the other houses in the area, maybe a little bit smaller. But it was when you got inside the house that you realized, wow. And the only way to describe it is to be quick and say, it's like somebody hurried up and finished it.
And that's because that is exactly what had happened. It turns out that Dave's house wasn't supposed to be the home for the groundskeeper.
In fact, the park was never supposed to be a park. It was private property that once belonged to a prominent black doctor. But the land was taken from him before he could even finish building his home.
That's reporter Sophie Codner.
I grew up near this park. I used to walk there after elementary school pretty much every day. It's in the town of Crèvecœur. It's a French name, Crèvecœur. But we pronounce it Crèvecœur. That's Midwestern French.
Today, Crèvecœur is mostly white, about 75%, and St. Louis, more broadly, is one of the most segregated cities in the United States. That didn't happen by accident. In the past, places like Crèvecœur actively prevented non-white people from moving in.
This is the story of one of those people. That prominent black doctor who back in the 1950s wanted his own piece of the suburban dream. It's about the lengths the town went to keep him from moving there, and a powerful legal tool that was used to uphold segregation. I didn't learn about this history growing up. In a white family, I should say. The people of Crèvecœur ignored it for decades, let it lie buried beneath the green grass of that neighborhood park. But in recent years, the story has resurfaced, forcing my hometown to finally face its ugly past.
Howard Philip Venable was a renowned ophthalmologist from Detroit. He graduated from medical school with honors in 1940 and became the first African-American to earn an ophthalmology degree from New York University 3 years later. He passed the board exam with the highest score since its inception.
I always knew him as a larger-than-life character.
That is Rosalind Venable Woodhouse, Dr. Venable's niece. Rosalind was close with her uncle growing up. She looked up to him. And she remembers going to the movies to watch her uncle in news clips that they'd play on the big screen.
That is what used to play between double features at the movies. And he would be featured because of his accomplishments.
Venable moved to St. Louis in 1943 during the era of Jim Crow. He worked as an eye doctor at the all-black Homer G. Phillips Hospital, which had a reputation for training some of the best nurses and doctors in the country. Venable taught there, too. He had this shtick where he would start his classes by asking students to spell ophthalmology.
That's O-P-H-T-H. That's 2 H's in there.
Glaucoma and cataracts were a big problem in African-American communities, so Venable wanted to prepare his residents to work with black patients specifically. One paper that he published on glaucoma in 1952 is still a crucial reference for ophthalmologists today.
Venable was also a Renaissance man. Outside of work, he was a talented trumpet player. He even played with legends like Ethel Waters and Duke Ellington.
And music was a big part of the Venable family life. When Dr. Venable and his brothers got together, they used to do this dance called the Sand.
You would spread sand out, literally like beach sand, on a hardwood floor. And the sound of the feet going over the sand was rhythmic.
He's always been a kind of dapper dresser. and he always talked eloquently, you know, and he had like a little funny laugh that he would put on, you know, and he was just a remarkable man, you know.
That's Alan Venable, Dr. Venable's nephew. Alan remembers his uncle as the life of the party.
He would talk to anybody. He loved to talk, number one. He just had a presence about himself because he knew what he was talking about and he could take over the room.
In the 1950s, Venable was a St. Louis socialite. He spent time in elite circles with wealthy Black and white people, and he was used to being the first Black person to step foot in places that had previously been for white people only.
And in 1956, he took one of those steps into the St. Louis suburb of Creve Coeur.
One day in March of 1956, Dr. Venable saw a small ad in a local newspaper promoting 22 vacant lots in Creve Coeur.
At the time, Creve Coeur was an all-white community, sparsely populated with plenty of open space. Venable purchased two of the lots. He paid upfront in cash.
My point was going back to what we said. I wanted freedom of choice. I wanted to be able to move anywhere that I had money I felt I could move to.
That is Dr. Howard Philip Venable himself, speaking on an oral history tape recorded in the 1980s.
Just like a white doctor with comparable financial status could move anywhere he wanted.
And Venable wanted to move to Creve Coeur to build his dream home.
Everybody was excited because it was ranch style. And that was the first time I had ever heard of a ranch style home. So that was kind of exotic in my little mind.
Venable's niece Rosalind was a teenager at the time. She remembers looking over the blueprints of her uncle's grand domestic vision.
Oh, yes, he was talking about a swimming pool, tennis courts, and a 9-hole golf course, all of that.
Then some of Venable's colleagues at the hospital got interested in the area, too. Soon, several more Black families started making plans to buy lots in Creve Coeur.
But achieving the suburban dream was never going to come easy, even for a group of accomplished doctors with savings and social capital.
Right away, some of the white residents in Creve Coeur started organizing against Venable and the other Black families. They were afraid that their property values would decline if the neighborhood became mixed race. So they devised a wholesome-looking plan with a sinister twist to keep their new neighbors out. They would build a park on the lots, and they quickly raised $25,000 amongst themselves to make it happen.
Dr. Venable says they successfully intimidated many of the other Black families.
All the other people took their money out because they scared them. They scared them. Said, if you don't get your money out of here, you'll lose everything. I went to them and said, look, that lot is yours. Even though it's down payment, it's like a car. If you make a down payment on a car, that car is yours. Unless you default on the payments, they can't take that away. They got scared.
The other families pulled their money out, but Venable decided to stay and fight. He had paid cash for his property. He owned it outright, and he wasn't about to give it up.
But I was a fighter, and I would criticize Blacks, whites, anybody if I thought I was right.
Dr. Venable hired an architect and started building a brick house right there on his land. But the white residents kept trying to push him out.
They tried to buy us out about 10 times. We wouldn't sell. Then they slapped on this eminent domain.
Eminent domain. That's how the U.S. government takes private property. The rule with eminent domain is that the government can only seize private land if it's for public use, for things that benefit the public, like roads, airports, and parks.
But throughout the 20th century, cities across the U.S. used eminent domain as a tool to take land away from Black people and keep neighborhoods segregated. Central Park in New York City was a Black neighborhood that got converted to a park using eminent domain. Bruce's Beach, a resort run by a Black couple in Los Angeles in the 1920s, suffered the same fate. In fact, Dr. Venable's first house in St. Louis was taken by the state to make a highway.
One study by the Institute for Justice found that in the 1950s and 60s, 1 million people in the U.S. were displaced through eminent domain. More than two-thirds of those people were African-American.
And that is exactly what was happening in Creve Coeur. Many white people supported an effort to use eminent domain to take Venable's land, where he was actively building his house, and turn it into a park.
They called it Byrne Park, after the mayor at the time, John T. Byrne, who was leading the eminent domain effort against Venable.
And Venable wasn't the only one that Creve Coeur was keeping out. It turns out the town was also trying to change its zoning code to prevent a Jewish temple called Temple Israel from being built just down the road from the park.
The Jewish people were in the same boat. They were having problems with the same people.
For 3 long years, Dr. Venable and the temple fought for their land in court. Venable's case went to the Missouri Court of Appeals, and the temple's case went to the Missouri Supreme Court.
So we were both in court at the same time. So their lawyers and our lawyers worked together to fight this thing, which was vicious. They were against them because they were Jewish. They were against me because they were black. And they had to make up these very stupid laws to take care of both of us.
The temple won their case. The Missouri Supreme Court ruled that religious freedom took precedence over the zoning laws the town was trying to impose.
But Dr. Venable didn't fare so well. In the end, after a long, expensive legal battle, the court sided with the town of Creve Coeur in December 1959. Dr. Venable got $31,000 for his land, which today would be worth a little under $300,000. He left town, and his property became Burn Park. Homes in the neighborhood today go for well over $1 million.
But that wasn't the end of Dr. Venable's dream. He moved his family to another town in Missouri called Baldwin. He says his neighbors there embraced him. Venable continued his successful medical career, and he built the house he always wanted. It even had a little pitch-and-putt golf course.
Dr. Venable's nephew, Alan, says the story of what happened to his family was written about widely at the time.
My grandmother read it in Detroit, Michigan, and right here about her son that was happening in St. Louis, you know. So it was, you know, a known fact.
But in Creve Coeur, it was all kept hush-hush. And as time passed, that known fact became unknown.
The material was there for them to know, but they didn't really want to know the way I looked at it.
But even if no one was talking about the history of the park, there were clues, out in the open for anyone to see. Venable's one-story brick ranch house, which was built to near completion during the legal battle, remained intact on the park grounds. The city used it as a home for the park groundskeeper.
Which is how, in the 1990s, Dave Davis came to live in Dr. Venable's half-finished dream home.
And like I said to you earlier, when you looked at the inside and you could just tell that there was something that was not completely finished about this, linoleum floors, inexpensive roll tile in the meeting room, just nothing that would be reflective of you believing that this was once somebody's intimately decorated home.
Dave was working towards an associate's degree at a local community college, and he enrolled in a folklore class to fulfill a requirement. He had a pretty good idea for the class project.
All my wondering about this house, all my wondering about all of this in the middle of this relatively affluent neighborhood and an older community, in an area where that would be premium real estate, this just seems to stand out to me, and I was curious. So I decided to pursue it, and I began doing my research.
Dave started talking to people at City Hall and in the Parks Department. He asked his neighbors if they knew anything about the history of the park. They didn't have much to say, so Dave started looking through old newspaper archives.
That's when I started learning about Dr. Venable. And I started with, like, wow, what an amazing guy.
From the old articles, Dave learned that Venable was this dynamic eye doctor with all of these accomplishments.
And then I started reading the rest of the story.
You know, the part where the city of Creve Coeur took Venable's land and turned it into a park.
I thought and assumed, maybe naively, Sophie, that, wow, well, if everybody knew the story, they're going to want to make this right.
Dave didn't know exactly what Creve Coeur would do with the information, but he kept documenting what he found for a school project. And he started talking about it to people in the neighborhood. He thought they should do something to honor Dr. Venable, that at the very least there should be a plaque at the park to tell the story of what happened.
But then it happened, and the phone call started at the house, asking, is this Dave Davis? Yes. You're the caretaker of Burn Park? Yes. You need to let go of this subject of the park and how it came to be.
Dave says he got about 5 of these calls. Each time, he'd pick up the phone and hear a different voice on the other end, one he didn't recognize. And with each call, the voices got more threatening.
The last phone call that I remember was, if you like living in Creve Coeur and want to continue to live in Creve Coeur and have your children attend a good school district, you'll let this go and drop it.
Dave doesn't know who was calling him. He has his ideas, but there's no way to know for sure. But Dave says he got nervous. Not afraid for his life or anything, but he was worried about retaliation. His family was just getting on their feet and starting to save some money.
I get emotional talking about it, so I'm going to... I was scared. It's like, I don't want to lose everything. I'm also embarrassed to admit to you that I dropped it. I let it go. I dropped the class. I stopped talking about it because I didn't want to lose what we had. Sorry.
I think Dave did what a lot of people would do. It's much easier to stay quiet, to keep the past in the past, when unearthing it would make people in the present uncomfortable. But when Dave dropped the class, Dr. Venable's story fell back into secrecy in Grief Corps.
Dave was the last person to work as the groundskeeper of Byrne Park. The city later tore the house down. Of course, the Venables never forgot what happened to them in Grief Corps. Over time, the story became a piece of family lore, although Rosalind Venable was quick to say that they weren't dwelling on it.
Well, you know, this isn't the only injustice that we've ever experienced. We are a Black family, so it's not like the emotions around this are new to us.
Rosalind went on to have a distinguished, varied career, much like her uncle. She was the first female chief motor vehicle administrator in the U.S. She earned a Ph.D. in educational policy, and she was the president and CEO of the Urban League in Seattle. For years, she didn't think much about Grief Corps, until the Venables got a call from a man named Jim Singer.
I was hoping that we could start from the beginning.
Well, there's really two stories. There's the story of what happened with Dr. Venable, and then there's the story of how Grief Corps kind of woke up from its slumber.
This is Jim Singer. He's a labor lawyer in St. Louis and a member of a Jewish temple in Grief Corps. He says one wake-up call was what happened in Ferguson.
About 10 miles from the park, in the summer of 2014, a police officer shot and killed Michael Brown. His death brought international attention to the Black Lives Matter movement and put St. Louis's history of segregation in the spotlight.
After Ferguson, some people in Grief Corps started looking more closely at the legacy of racism in their own neighborhood.
When I looked around, I realized this had been the park that I'd been to with my parents like 60 years earlier. And I just started wondering, you know, does anybody remember what my mom told me? Did she have it right?
Jim had a vague memory of hearing about Dr. Venable from his parents when he was just a kid. And it all came back to him one day at the park with his grandson. So he started doing research, and it was all right there.
It was well publicized at the time, even though people later forgot about it. It was covered by the Post. It was covered in the African-American press. So it wasn't exactly a secret what Grief Corps had done at the time.
Jim started writing an article about the history of the park with the Missouri Historical Society. And then in 2019, he started working on a movement to rename the park. He got his Jewish temple and Grief Corps involved too. They wanted to strip the park of its original name, Byrne Park, and rename it after Dr. Venable.
They made a Facebook group, the Venable Park Coalition, and invited residents to join. They put together a public event at a local auditorium to have an open discussion of the history. And then they reached out to the Venable family, including Alan and Rosalind. <laughs> 200 people filled the auditorium. The mayor patched in Rosalind on speakerphone.
We have the Venables form?
Yes, we do.
Terrific.
There was excitement in the room, some nervousness. More than 6 decades had passed since Dr. Venable had been pushed out of Grief Corps. Rosalind had been a teenager back then. She had seen the blueprints for her uncle's home, and she had heard all about his dreams for the neighborhood. Now, after all these years, she was about to speak to the people of Grief Corps directly. No one in the auditorium knew what she would say.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
I am Rosalind Venable Woodhouse, niece of Dr. Howard P. Venable.
Rosalind started by thanking Jim Singer and the rest of the Venable Park Coalition. And then she got to the heart of the matter.
Ironically, in French,
creature means broken heart. Indeed, it was a source of heartbreak to the Venables and continues as such in the lives of their descendants. It was the source of the denial of an essential element of the American dream, the right to own a home.
The family then had some recommendations for Creve Coeur. They wanted the park renamed after Dr. Venable, and they wanted the city to build a memorial in honor of all the Black people who attempted to integrate the neighborhood.
They also proposed that the town establish a fund, or land bank, to provide city-owned land or down payment assistance to non-white people who want to buy or build homes in the area.
The crowd sounded very receptive to and supportive of doing something that would acknowledge the terrible injustice that had taken place.
After the public event, the Creve Coeur City Council voted unanimously to change the park's name. Byrne Park became Dr. H. Philip Venable Memorial Park.
Venable Park is sacred ground to me.
Nicole Greer is Creve Coeur's only Black city council member. She appreciates the name change. She says visiting the park feels different now.
Sometimes it's tough, you know, to go because you get really emotional, but there's always going to be this element of, you know, me thinking about why this is a park, because it's not even supposed to be a park.
For Nicole and other people in Creve Coeur, just renaming the park was not going to cut it. So the city formed a task force in 2020 to figure out what else they were going to do.
And the mayor of Creve Coeur, he asked me if I could sit on the task force. Obviously, they needed a Black presence on the task force. And I was willing to serve and share my opinions.
Richard Miller is another Creve Coeur resident. He keeps it candid on the Venable Park task force.
I don't bite my tongue. I just tell the truth. And I say things that some people are afraid to say.
For example, Rich is not afraid to say that the city of Creve Coeur owes a debt. And not like a metaphorical debt. They owe money.
Some folks have a problem with that name, reparations, with that term. So if that is an issue, then let's not call it reparations. Okay, let's call it something else. Let's call it honest money, or fair money, or money to make folks whole again.
Critics of reparations sometimes argue that it's impossible to figure out who owes how much and to whom. But the Creve Coeur case is clear-cut and well-documented. The financial losses to the Venable family are concrete. You can calculate them.
And so for Rich, it's important that Creve Coeur make it up to the Venable family by paying them directly, or by funding something like the land bank that the family recommended.
We found money for a police station, $11 million, that we really didn't need, okay? And we did that by issuing a proposition, okay? And we got the residents to agree on it. Why can't we issue a proposition to raise money, taxpayers' dollars, to make the Venable family whole?
Since the founding of the United States, land has equaled economic opportunity. In this country, owning property has been key to building wealth that lasts from one generation to the next.
Today, home ownership for Black Americans is 30% lower than for white Americans, and white families have a net worth that is 10 times higher on average than that of Black families. Eminent domain is part of the reason why.
In Creve Coeur, the Venables and the other Black families weren't just bullied out of town. They were bullied out of the opportunity to grow wealth there by owning a home.
Those are million-dollar houses over there. You took that away from them. And I think you should be compensated for it, you know, one way or another.
In September of 2021, Rosalind and Alan got a chance to visit Venable Park for the first time. The house is no longer there, but they had been hearing about this area and what happened here since childhood. Finally, they saw it with their own eyes.
When I saw the park, I got a rush. I was almost I was almost dizzy because I had no idea that it was so beautiful. And it was quite an experience to actually see it for the first time.
Actually, when I arrived at the park, boy, it almost made you want to cry. You know, because you saw all the beautiful homes. All the beautiful homes and lots and everything was all kept up together. And this man had picked this area out, you know. And it made me think, like, if I love something and I want something, but it don't love me, you know. It don't want me, you know. And that's a terrible thing, for you to love something and something don't love you back.
The people of Creve Coeur have so far been more than willing to support a symbolic kind of racial justice, a name change.
I think naming the park is just a start. It's just a starting point.
Right now, the city is making plans for a memorial at the park. And it's still possible that something more like reparations could happen too. Because as nice as symbolic gestures are, Alan Venable wants the people of Creve Coeur to remember this about his uncle.
He didn't want no park.
Not even a big, beautiful park with his name on it.
He didn't want a park, no. He wanted to build his home and raise a family there.
Coming up, more on how eminent domain was used across the country to strip Black homeowners of their land and a new movement to get some of it back. After this. So I'm back with Sophie Codner, who brought us that piece about eminent domain. And you know about this story because this was a particular incident that happened in your hometown. But this whole concept of eminent domain, you know, taking land from people is really a national issue.
Yeah, so this happened in Creve Coeur, where I'm from, but it also happened all over the country. Eminent domain was a big part of the urban renewal efforts that happened after World War II in the 1950s and 60s. Cities across the country would get funding from the federal government to basically bulldoze certain neighborhoods. They'd call them blighted or substandard. And they do that to make space for newer development, and was often used to target low-income neighborhoods and neighborhoods of color. And outside of urban renewal, eminent domain was used to target specific people, too.
And this is what happened in the case with Dr. Venable, right?
Yeah, exactly. It often had to do with keeping areas segregated or taking particularly valuable land, specifically for its resources. So, again, there are a lot of stories like this all around the country. And while I was reporting, I learned about this organization I thought was really interesting called Where Is My Land? And they're actually focused on this exact issue, reclaiming land stolen from Black people. I talked with Ashanti Martin about it. She's one of the founders.
We were established in 2021, and our mission is to help Black families in America reclaim stolen land and secure restitution.
2021 is really recent. So how did they get started?
Yeah, the organization was born out of this incident in Southern California that came to a head last year. It was this place called Bruce's Beach, which was a popular resort owned by a Black couple. Their names were Willa and Charles Bruce. And in the 1920s, the city of Manhattan Beach used eminent domain to take the land. And the city said they wanted it for a park.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds exactly like the Venable story.
Right. So Ashanti's co-founder, her name's Kevon Ward, she was living in Manhattan Beach when she heard about this history. And after George Floyd was killed, she decided to hold an event at Bruce's Beach Park on Juneteenth in 2020 to get the word out to the community about what had happened to the Bruces. Some of the Bruce family ended up attending the picnic, and that's when Kevon decided there should really be a way, some policy mechanism, to actually return the land of the park to the Bruce family. She led some community organizing, advocacy work. There was definitely a lot of pushback. But in the fall of 2021, it happened. And it's thought to be the first time in the history of the United States that land stolen from Black people was actually returned to their descendants.
Wow.
Bruce's Beach and Gavon's work showed that something can be done. If we can find evidence that, you know, a family or an individual owned land and it was taken from them by various means, and particularly if those means were racially motivated, then we have to do something about that.
Ashanti told me that part of the reason she wanted to start Where Is My Land with Kavan actually came from reading more about George Floyd's family history. She read about it in a story in the Washington Post.
And one of the parts of that story that just really stayed with me and stuck with me is that his great-great-grandfather, a man named Hillary Thomas Stewart Jr., he had acquired a few hundred acres of land in North Carolina. And as told to the Washington Post by George Floyd's family, that land was seized by white farmers. So it just becomes very salient and palpable that this history is directly connected to some of the issues that we're facing now.
I mean, it's such an important point because, you know, first we knew such a narrow slice of the end of George Floyd's life, like literally, like on tape. And then, you know, you get to know him as a person his whole life. And to think about like the whole history of his family and how it all led to this moment is really powerful stuff.
Right. It's like, you know, thinking about cards being stacked against someone. And that's yeah. sort of that's what systematic racism is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Ashanti told me, you know, like these are facts. These aren't feelings. She's looking at the hard evidence behind these stories. Where Is My Land is actually trying to create a database of land that was stolen by eminent domain and by other means. On their website, they have a page where Black families can register their land, and they've already gotten hundreds of claims.
We have cases from Connecticut to California. A lot of cases are, of course, concentrated in the South. And they really span rural, urban, and suburban land. They go back to, you know, right around the time of, you know, Reconstruction up through the 21st century. So that's really why we exist, is to get at this from a national level, and to just really wake people up as to the history specifically of the racially motivated theft of Black land.
So Where Is My Land is really trying to turn land reclamation into a movement.
It has been so easy to ignore these families for so long because they haven't had anybody in their court fighting for them. So that's really what we want to change.
I think we're going to be hearing more and more stories like Bruce's Beach and Venable Park.
I mean, it's interesting because in the story that you reported, the Venable family didn't express interest in having the park and Creve Coeur returned to them as land, you know.
Right. Yeah. So actually returning the land of the park to the Venable family hasn't really been part of the discussion so far. I think right now the Venable family and the Creve Coeur task force are really focused on this memorial. They want to redesign the park and make it a destination, a place where people can go and learn about the history of the park and also of housing discrimination more broadly, and sort of talk about this from a national perspective. But I will say that much like Venable Park was renamed recently, Bruce's Beach Park was renamed for the Bruces in 2007. And, you know, 14 years later, the land was returned.
Wow. That's fascinating stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing the story with us and this addendum. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Roman.
99% Invisible was produced this week by Sophie Codner, edited by Emmett Fitzgerald, mix and tech production by Martin Gonzalez. Delaney Hall is the executive producer. Kurt Kohlstedt is our digital director. The rest of the team includes Vivian Leigh, Chris Berube, Christopher Johnson, Joe Rosenberg, Lashma Dawn, Jason DeLeon, Sophia Klatsker, and me, Roman Mars. Music by our director of sound, Swan Real, plus an additional song, La Pereza, by Duke Ellington and his Kentucky Club Orchestra. Special thanks this week to the Venable family, including Victoria Venable Fletcher and Crystal Venable, Sydney Jackson, Kimberly Norwood, Steve Stradahl, Eric Berger, Mark and Nancy Codner, the Office of the City of Creve Coeur, the Missouri Historical Society, and the audio program at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. We are part of the Stitcher and Sirius XM podcast family, now headquartered 6 blocks north in the Pandora Building, in beautiful Uptown, Oakland, California. You can find the show and join discussions about the show on Facebook. You can tweet me at Roman Mars and the show at 99pi.org. We're on Instagram and Reddit too. You can find links to other Stitcher shows I love, as well as every past episode of 99pi at 99pi.org. Stitcher. Serious. Excellent. Our limited series, The Future Of, sponsored by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, is all about exploring how changes to the way we live, learn, work, and play may shape our health and well-being in years to come. Our second episode in the series, which we will release as a bonus episode of 99PI this week, is all about the future of broadband, a thing once viewed as a home luxury that is now a requirement for navigating the modern world. People without good internet access are at a severe disadvantage.
Education, economic development and opportunity, which I'm relating to jobs, you are stricken from that.
That is Monique Tate, a digital justice advocate.
If you go somewhere and say, I'm interested in a job, can I just fill out a piece of paper? No one has that for you to do anymore. They're going to say, if you can't submit your application, we can't even consider you.
On the next 99% Invisible, we'll look at the past and future of broadband and the solutions people are coming up with to solve what's known as the last mile problem. This special episode is the second in a four-part series we created exploring the future of health and well-being. Each episode examines what we could do today to create a healthier, more equitable future. Thanks to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for their sponsorship of The Future Of. To not miss a single episode, all you have to do is subscribe to 99% Invisible.